Right now, the United States exports roughly 70% of the world's blood plasma.
Which is just a wild statistic when you actually stop and think about it.
It really is. I mean, think about that for a second. We are basically the Saudi Arabia of human blood.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
And the entire globe relies on, a single country to supply this vital biological material. We're talking about the stuff that's necessary to create life-saving therapies for everything from immune deficiencies to trauma recovery.
Right, the real heavy-hitting medical treatments.
Exactly. And the reason for this massive global monopoly isn't because Americans have, like, inherently better blood.
Or even more advanced medical technology, really.
Right. It actually comes down to a single incredibly powerful emotion, which is disgust.
Disgust, yeah.
Almost every other developed nation on Earth considers paying a human being for their blood plasma to be morally repugnant. It gives them essentially the yuck factor.
They just find it gross.
They find it gross. So what do? They ban the practice to keep their collective conscience clean, right? And then they quietly import thousands of liters of paid American plasma to keep their own citizens alive.
The irony there is just breathtaking when you look at the global supply
It
chains,
really is.
because entire countries are essentially outsourcing their moral compromises. They get to maintain this pristine aesthetic of pure, uncompensated altruism within their own
Right, they get to
borders.
feel good about themselves.
Exactly, while at the same time completely depending on a commodified paid market just across the ocean.
And that hypocrisy is exactly what we're getting into today. Welcome to the Deep Dive. We are pulling from a really fascinating conversation recently featured in a Substack newsletter by Yasha Monk.
Such a good piece.
It really was. He sat down with Alvin E. Roth, who is a Nobel laureate, a Stanford economics professor, and the author of a book called Moral Economics. From prostitution to organ sales, what controversial transactions reveal about how markets work?
That subtitle really covers a lot of ground.
It absolutely does. And the underlying thread here, the tension connecting all these ideas, is this friction between protecting people and just being grossed out.
Yeah, we mix those two things up all the time.
We do. Our mission for you listening today is to unpack this invisible, often totally irrational force that dictates our economy and, frankly, our life or death public policies.
Wow.
Because, like you said, we often mistake the act of protecting people for simply being grossed out.
And that confusion has real consequences.
Massive consequences.
Yeah.
We are going to explore how that fundamental confusion engineers deadly shortages, creates sprawling black markets, and even empowers criminal syndicates. Okay, let's unpack this because Al Roth brings a really unique perspective to this whole conversation.
He does, yeah. Because he isn't just some theoretical economist sitting in an ivory tower somewhere crunching numbers. He is an actual pioneer in a highly specialized field called market design.
Market design.
Right. And to really understand his argument, we first have to sort of fundamentally redefine what a market actually is.
Because when most people hear the word market, they picture, I don't know, the New York Stock Exchange.
Yeah, exactly. Guys in suits shouting on a trading floor. Or like a sterile graph of supply and demand from a college textbook.
Right. But Roth views markets completely differently. He sees them as ancient foundational human tools. I mean, since the very dawn of civilization, we have been engineering systems to coordinate with one another,
Right.
for to trade resources, to solve complex logistical problems.
He actually goes a step further and uses this really compelling metaphor. He describes markets as languages.
Languages.
Yeah, think about it like this. A language has grammar, it has syntax, it has vocabulary, all of which allows two human beings to communicate a really complex idea.
Okay, I follow that.
So, in an economic sense, price is basically a vocabulary word. A contract is a grammatical structure. When a market is functioning correctly, it allows us to signal to each other, I have an excess of this resource, you have a deficit over there, here is the syntax we use to coordinate an exchange.
That makes total sense. So, taking that language metaphor to its logical conclusion, when a government steps in and bans a specific type of transaction, not because it's inherently harmful, but
Right.
just because it feels taboo, they're essentially censoring the vocabulary.
That's exactly it. They are deciding that certain words literally cannot be spoken.
Wow.
And when you ban the words people use to signal distress or need, you don't actually eliminate the need itself.
Right, the person is still hungry or still sick.
Exactly. You just force those people to whisper in the shadows instead of speaking clearly in the open.
Let me offer a slightly more mechanical analogy here because I want to make sure we ground this in practical engineering for everyone listening.
Sure.
Let's look at a market as a literal tool, like a wrench.
A wrench, okay.
A wrench is just a forged piece of steel designed to turn a bolt. It doesn't have a moral alignment. A wrench cannot be inherently evil or benevolent, right?
Right, it's just an object.
It is merely effective or ineffective at solving a physical problem. What Roth points out in this interview is that society treats certain economic transactions, certain uses of the wrench, as morally corrupt, simply for existing.
I like that analogy. The only problem with the wrench idea is that it implies a totally static tool, whereas human markets are highly dynamic. They're constantly interacting with our weird human psychology.
That's fair, yeah.
But your premise totally holds up. We frequently throw the wrench out the window while the pipe is still actively leaking, purely because we don't like the color of the metal.
Sure.
We prioritize our aesthetic sensibilities over actual functional survival.
And we know the tool works when we are actually allowed to pick it up and use it.
Yeah.
I mean, Roth's Nobel Prize wasn't awarded for abstract philosophy. He literally engineers human coordination.
Yeah, he built things that work.
Look at the medical residency matching system.
Oh, this is such a good example.
Right. For decades, the process of pairing graduating medical students with hospitals was just an absolute disaster.
A total mess.
Hospitals would issue what were called exploding offers.
Exploding offers. Just the name sounds stressful.
It was awful. A clinic in Boston would call a medical student and say, we are offering you a residency, but you have exactly 4 hours to accept, or we are hanging up and giving it to someone else.
Which created this incredibly chaotic, high-stress environment where the market completely unraveled.
Yeah.
Students were forced to accept their third or maybe fourth choice hospitals out of sheer panic because they were terrified that if they held out for their top choice, they would end up with absolutely nothing.
So the communication between the two parties just broke down entirely. The language failed.
What's fascinating here is how human bias interferes with mathematical market efficiency. Roth and his colleagues didn't just write a complaining paper about this broken system. They built a new algorithm to fix it.
They actually turned the wrench.
Exactly. They implemented a version of the deferred acceptance algorithm, which is famously associated with David Gale and Lloyd Shapley. So instead of a frantic telephone game of exploding offers, students now submit a ranked list of their dream hospitals. And the hospitals submit a ranked list of the students they want.
Oh.
And then the algorithm acts as a centralized clearinghouse. It tentatively matches people and constantly updates as better matches become available until the entire system settles into the most stable possible configuration.
The mechanics of that algorithm are just beautiful because they totally eliminate the incentive to lie or to panic.
Right. You don't have to game the system anymore.
Exactly. A student can put their absolute dream hospital at the very top of their list without fear of being penalized if they don't get it. The algorithm just naturally moves to their second choice.
Roth engineered a system where the optimal strategy is simply to tell the truth about what you want. He proved that when you design the rules of the market thoughtfully, you can solve massive, complex social coordination problems.
And this is the absolute crux of the issue here.
Yeah.
Society only allowed Roth to fix that specific market because we don't have a moral objection to doctors finding jobs.
That's a great point.
Nobody is morally disgusted by a computer pairing a pediatrician with a pediatric ward in Chicago.
No, we applaud that.
Right. The wrench was allowed to turn the bolt. But when a market brushes up against something society deems sacred or taboo or gross, the efficiency of the tool suddenly becomes totally irrelevant.
Yeah.
We just ban the tool entirely.
And that brings us to the most visceral, really high-stakes application of Roth's theories that they discussed in the Yasha Monk interview. We have to look at the global kidney shortage.
Yeah.
This is where market design collides violently with human morality.
The numbers laid out in the text are just devastating.
Hmm.
In the United States alone, there were approximately 130,000 cases of kidney failure every single year.
130,000.
130,000 human beings whose bodies can no longer filter toxins, who are suddenly tethered to dialysis machines just to stay alive. But the system only performs fewer than 30,000 transplants annually.
So there's this massive gap.
A huge gap. We're talking about 100,000 people every single year who need an organ and simply cannot get one.
And dialysis is not a cure. It's a grueling, exhausting process that only mimics a tiny fraction of a healthy kidney's function. The longer a patient remains on dialysis, the more their cardiovascular system just degrades.
Their life expectancy plummets.
Exactly. It is a slow, agonizing decline. So you have this massive, desperate demand for a biological resource.
And the supply side is artificially capped by the law. It is a federal felony in the United States to provide financial compensation to a living donor for a kidney.
A federal felony.
You can go to federal prison for attempting to pay someone to save your life with their spare organ. The market is legally mandated to operate strictly on pure, uncompensated altruism.
And Ralph has actually spent a significant portion of his career operating within the very strict confines of that specific legal restriction.
Right.
He helped develop the kidney exchange programs. And we really should break down how those work because they are a masterclass in navigating a restricted market. But they also expose the hard ceiling of relying purely on altruism.
Let's walk through the mechanics of a kidney exchange because it's brilliant. Imagine my brother is in total renal failure. I love my brother, and I am perfectly willing to give him one of my kidneys.
Okay.
We go to the hospital, they run the tests, and they discover our blood types are incompatible. Or perhaps he has antibodies that would immediately attack my tissue.
Right. A positive cross match.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If they put my kidney in his body, he will reject it and likely die.
Mm.
Under the old system, my willingness to donate was rendered entirely useless. We were just at a dead end.
But Roth and his colleagues looked at that dead end and saw a matching problem, just like the medical students.
Right.
They realized there were thousands of incompatible donor-recipient pairs scattered all across the country. So they designed an algorithm to swap them.
So smart.
If your kidney is incompatible with your brother, but it happens to match a patient in Seattle, and that patient in Seattle has a willing donor who happens to match your brother, you swap.
Wow.
You give your kidney to the stranger in Seattle, and their donor gives a kidney to your brother.
And it gets even more complex than that with these non-simultaneous extended altruistic donor chains.
Oh, yeah. The chains are incredible.
You get someone who just wants to donate a kidney out of the goodness of their heart, an undirected donor.
Yeah.
They give a kidney to someone in an incompatible pair. Then that recipient's original incompatible donor essentially pays it forward to the next incompatible pair,
yeah,
and so on. We've seen chains that involve dozens of people creating this massive logistical puzzle of shared altruism.
And those algorithms are a total triumph of mathematics and logistics. They have squeezed every possible drop of efficiency out of the existing pool of willing donors. They've saved thousands of lives.
Mm.
But as you highlighted, there's a fundamental flaw. You are only shuffling the existing deck. You are organizing the altruism that is already there, but you are not increasing the raw number of people willing to give up a body part.
The demand is a roaring, raging river, and pure altruism is just a trickling stream. No matter how perfectly you engineer the distribution of that stream, people are still going to die of thirst.
Which brings us to the End Kidney Deaths Act.
Yes.
This is a proposed piece of legislation that Monk and Roth discuss in the newsletter, and it pushes aggressively against our societal boundaries.
Let's get into the details of that because it's controversial.
Very. The proposal introduces a tangible financial incentive. It suggests offering a significant tax credit, essentially $10,000 a year for 5 years.
$50,000 total.
Exactly. $50,000 total to non-directed living donors. It is a financial reward funded directly by the government in exchange for an organ.
Okay, I am going to push back hard on this because I really want to represent the very real discomfort people feel when they hear that proposal.
Oh, totally. It makes people wince.
The immediate reaction is this sounds incredibly dystopian. I mean, if you attach a $50,000 bounty to a human organ, you are inevitably going to target the most financially desperate people in society.
That is the standard counterargument, yes.
Like if I am facing eviction, unable to feed my children, drowning in medical debt, and the government comes along and offers me 50 grand for my kidney, is my consent really free? Or is it coerced by poverty?
It feels coercive.
People view this as the wealthy effectively harvesting the bodies of the poor to extend their own lives. And that isn't just a simple aesthetic judgment. That feels like a profound violation of human dignity and a really predatory capitalist dynamic.
And that reaction is incredibly common. And honestly, it is the exact reason the current ban exists. But Roth approaches this from the perspective of pure consequentialism.
Consequentialism.
Right. The ethical framework of consequentialism dictates that the morality of an action is judged solely by its outcomes. So if we analyze your hypothetical scenario through that lens, we have to look at the alternatives.
Well, the alternative is that the poor person keeps their kidney.
They keep their kidney, yes. But they also keep their crushing poverty. They keep their eviction notice and their inability to feed their children.
Right.
Banning the organ market does absolutely nothing to cure the systemic poverty that made the $50,000 appealing in the first place. It just removes a powerful financial lifeline from the desperate person.
That's a dark way to look at it, but it's true.
And more importantly, the person on dialysis still dies. Under the current system, we have two tragedies. The person remains destitute and the patient dies. Under the tax credit system, the patient lives and the poor person receives $50,000 to drastically alter their financial trajectory.
Yasha Monk actually wrestles with this directly in the interview. He admits that he isn't a strict consequentialist. He believes certain things might be inherently wrong, regardless of the outcome. But he makes a really compelling point about the sheer scale of the suffering. He says that when the consequences of a rule are very obviously fatal, when prohibiting the buying and selling of organs leads directly to tens of thousands of people needlessly suffocating on their own failing blood chemistry, you need an incredibly weighty argument to justify that ban.
And Roth states it so plainly. He says, quote, millions of people are dying of kidney disease. I would want to at least weigh that idea against the cost of all these deaths.
It's sobering.
It is. What we're doing right now is prioritizing our collective sense of moral cleanliness over the physical survival of 100,000 human beings.
We're choosing aesthetics over lives.
Exactly. We are looking at a patient on dialysis and basically saying, your impending death is a tragedy, but allowing you to purchase a kidney would insult our sensibilities about the sanctity of the human body. So please, die with dignity.
God, it is incredibly grim when you strip away the sanitized political language. And Roth points out an economic inevitability that makes the ban even more destructive. When you criminalize a market that possesses massive, desperate demand, the market does not just evaporate.
It simply migrates.
It goes underground. The ban doesn't stop kidney sales. It just ensures that those sales are controlled by the absolute worst actors in society.
Right now, there is a thriving global market for kidneys.
A huge one.
But it isn't managed by Stanford economists or regulated hospital boards. It is managed by organ traffickers and international crime syndicates.
Wow.
Wealthy patients travel abroad to unregulated clinics where desperate people from impoverished nations sell their organs for just a fraction of what they're actually worth.
And I imagine they get terrible care.
Often with zero postoperative medical care, they face massive risks of infection and lifelong complications. So our moral disgust hasn't actually protected the poor. It has thrown them into an unregulated black market where they are genuinely exploited without any legal recourse whatsoever.
Which leads to one of Roth's central maxims, which is, one of the most effective ways to fight black markets is with legal, regulated markets. You simply cannot legislate human desperation out of existence.
You really can't.
This friction between safety and morality forces us to define some crucial terms here. Roth makes a really sharp distinction between paternalism and repugnance.
Yes, this distinction is huge.
Understanding the difference between these two concepts is basically essential for analyzing almost any controversial law.
So paternalism is when the government restricts your freedom in order to protect you from objective, measurable harm. The state basically acts as a parent.
Right, like a seatbelt law.
A perfect example. Or a mandate that construction workers have to wear hard hats. You might personally want the freedom to drive without a seatbelt, but the government looks at the actuarial data, sees the massive societal cost of traumatic brain injuries and fatalities, and says, we are restricting your choice because the physical harm is undeniable.
The objective is pure safety. But repugnance operates on a completely different frequency. Repugnance is when the government bans a transaction purely because a majority society finds it morally disgusting, even if both parties are fully consenting adults and neither is suffering objective non-consensual harm.
Right.
The goal of a repugnance law isn't physical safety. It is the enforcement of a specific moral aesthetic.
The contrast between the kidney shortage and the blood plasma surplus we discussed at the very beginning of the deep dive is the perfect case study for this.
Let's bring it back to the plasma.
It proves exactly what happens when you prioritize functional market design over aesthetic repugnance.
Let's look closer at that plasma dynamic. The United States decided legally that compensating someone for the time and the physical toll of sitting in a clinic for an hour to donate blood plasma is acceptable.
It's treated as a job almost.
Yeah. It is a regulated legal transaction. The donor is compensated usually on a prepaid debit card right there on the spot. The clinic processes the plasma, and pharmaceutical companies turn it into life-saving immunoglobulins.
And because the market language is allowed to function, because that price signal is allowed to incentivize the behavior, there is absolutely no shortage of plasma in the United States.
None at all.
We meet our domestic demand entirely, and we generate such a massive surplus that we supply the vast majority of the planet.
Meanwhile, countries that cling to the repugnance model, banning compensation because it offends their notion of pure altruism, suffer perpetual, dangerous shortages.
They never have enough.
Never. They are forced to rely on the very commodified market they condemn. They keep their own laws aesthetically pure by importing the fruits of our dirty market.
It's such a double standard.
It is a stark, undeniable demonstration that overcoming the yuck factor solves the shortage.
And Roth actually extends this lens of repugnance to analyze the catastrophic failure of the war on drugs. He draws a direct and pretty haunting parallel to the prohibition of alcohol in the 1920s.
Let's talk about prohibition. During alcohol prohibition, the government attempted to ban a wildly popular market using a combination of paternalism, arguing that alcohol destroyed families and caused liver disease and moral repugnance, which was driven largely by the temperance movement.
Right, a mix of safety and morals.
But passing the Volstead Act didn't magically rewrite human neurology.
No.
The demand for intoxication remained. The language of the market was censored, so people just started whispering.
And nature abhors a vacuum. When legitimate businesses, which were bound by contract law and health regulations, were forced out of the alcohol market, violent criminal syndicates immediately filled the void.
Exactly.
We essentially birthed the modern mafia because we made a high-demand product illegal. Al Capone didn't build an empire by inventing a new product. He built it by managing the logistics of a banned market.
Roth points out that the exact same mechanics are driving the modern drug cartels right now. The government has banned a massive market, but as Roth states bluntly, the ban lacks social support.
That concept of social support is so critical in legal theory.
What does that mean exactly?
So a law is only truly effective if the vast majority of the population intrinsically agrees with it and voluntarily complies. The law against murder, for example, has near universal social support.
Right.
We don't require an armed police officer on every single street corner to prevent neighbors from killing each other because most people have an internal moral compass that naturally prohibits murder.
But the ban on drugs does not possess that internal compliance. Millions of perfectly normal, functional people want to consume these substances.
Yeah, just do.
Because there is no broad social support for the ban, the black market thrives. Roth says, and this is a quote, "We have a great deal of drugs, even though they're against the law. We are losing the war on drugs."
And this touches on the true source of the violence associated with the drug trade. Think about it. If you operate a legal business, say, a coffee shop, and your supplier fails to deliver a shipment of beans, what do? You take them to civil court.
Right, you sue them.
You rely on the justice system to enforce your contracts. But if you are a cartel moving cocaine, and your distributor steals a shipment, you cannot exactly call the police.
Hello, 911. My cocaine is missing.
Exactly. You can't file a lawsuit. The only mechanism available to enforce your contract and protect your market share is extreme, terrifying violence.
Wow.
The violence is a structural byproduct of the market being illegal, not necessarily the chemical nature of the substance itself.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because we are actually seeing the real-time unwinding of this repugnance with marijuana legalization.
Oh, absolutely.
State by state, the aesthetic judgment against cannabis has just collapsed. And Roth notes something profound about this transition. He argues that we shouldn't regret the fact that marijuana is now legally available, because the reality is it was always available when it was a felony.
It was everywhere.
Right.
The prohibition was just an illusion of control. The law did not eliminate the plant. It merely dictated who profited from it and how much blood was spilled in its distribution.
Banning a high-demand market doesn't make it vanish. It just hands the management franchise over to the worst elements of society. If a market is inevitable, the adult question isn't, how do we stop this?
No.
The question is, who do we want managing this? Do we want the supply chain managed by a regulated entity that checks IDs, tests products for fentanyl, and pays taxes? Or do we want to leave the quality control and dispute resolution in the hands of heavily armed cartels?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, as we track these shifts from the end of alcohol prohibition to the current wave of marijuana legalization, we uncover a fundamental truth about repugnance.
Which is?
It is incredibly fragile. What if society finds morally disgusting changes drastically from generation to generation?
That is so true. The text highlights this by pointing to the rapidly evolving ethics surrounding sex work, surrogacy, and the explosive cultural impact of platforms like OnlyFans.
OnlyFans is perhaps the most perfect contemporary case study of how quickly the window of repugnance can shift when technology democratizes a market.
It really is. I mean, 15 or 20 years ago, the idea of millions of everyday people, teachers, nurses, college students, independently monetizing intimate or explicit images of themselves would have triggered overwhelming universal societal repugnance.
It would have been a massive scandal.
The cultural stigma would have been totally devastating, and the legal system would have furiously attempted to suppress it under obscenity laws. It was heavily stigmatized precisely because it challenged traditional notions of female modesty and the gatekeeping of the traditional pornography industry.
Yet today, while it certainly remains a subject of heated debate, it has become a massive mainstream economic engine.
It's just a side hustle for a lot of people now.
Exactly. The cultural yuck factor has demonstrably diminished for a vast segment of the population. Individuals are fundamentally reevaluating what it means to own their bodily autonomy, their digital image, and their labor. The aesthetic judgment shifted almost overnight.
Which proves that repugnance is entirely subjective. It is a moving target, dictated by cultural trends, religious shifts, and technological advancements. And if repugnance is just a temporary fashion trend in morality, it is an incredibly dangerous foundation upon which to build our legal system.
It really is. If we allow temporary disgust to dictate permanent policy, we engineer permanent tragedies.
Oh.
We condemn a father to die on a kidney waitlist because paying a donor feels tacky today. We allow cartels to decimate communities because regulating a narcotic feels unsavory right now.
Mm-hmm.
We force sex workers into dangerous, unpoliced shadows because their profession offends the current moral sensibilities of the voting majority.
So what does this all mean? We have journeyed from the pristine mathematical theory of the medical residency match to the grim realities of the organ shortage, the global hypocrisy of the blood plasma trade, and the systemic violence of the war on drugs. They have to pull all of this together.
Synthesizing the brilliant insights from L. Roth and Yasha Monk, the overarching thesis is inescapable here. When a society legislates based primarily on aesthetic disgust, when we attempt to force our personal yuck factor onto the macroeconomy, we do not eradicate the behavior we dislike. We simply create a vacuum.
And vacuums are inherently destabilizing. They generate deadly shortages. They empower predators. They turn functional tools into weapons of exploitation. The central lesson of economic history, the thread connecting all of these disparate topics, is that you cannot bomb a black market out of existence.
You really can't.
You cannot arrest your way out of a biological reality. The only proven method to defeat a black market is to outcompete it with a safe, transparent, and legally regulated alternative.
This is where the academic theory demands practical application from you, the listener.
Right.
You are an active participant in this system. Every election cycle, you are asked to vote on ballot measures, elect representatives, and form opinions on deeply controversial topics.
The next time you find yourself evaluating a polarizing policy, whether it's a debate over decriminalizing sex work, legalizing a new class of psychedelics, reforming zoning laws for affordable housing, or addressing the healthcare crisis, stop and ask yourself one piercing question.
Is this proposed policy genuinely trying to prevent objective non-consensual harm?
Or is it merely trying to prevent a specific group of people from feeling grossed out? Are we acting as a rational, protective society, or are we just acting as the moral fashion police?
It requires a profound, often uncomfortable shift in perspective. You have to separate the empirical consequences of an action from your initial, visceral, emotional reaction to it.
You have to look at the wrench and judge it exclusively by how effectively it turns the leaking bolt, completely ignoring your distaste for the shape of the handle.
Because history and economics both warn us that our personal discomfort is never a valid justification for another human being's suffering. If redesigning a market can save 100,000 lives, our aesthetic objections are exposed as tragically selfish.
We started this deep dive with Al Roth's beautiful structural metaphor of markets as languages. We established that markets are complex languages. Humans have developed over millennia to coordinate our resources, communicate our most desperate needs, and ultimately survive in a world of scarcity.
They are the communication network of our collective existence.
If markets are essentially the languages of human survival, what essential words are we currently forbidding ourselves from speaking? and who, right now, is quietly dying in the dark because of our censorship.